there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for this hour of medical news, healthcare and science in the news, debate, dialogue, discussion, and answers to your questions and calls, emails, or, well, we never know what's coming up on Ask Dr. Dawn, and here we are winding up the year. So before I go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. I wanted to start off with a little memorial. This is gleaned from this month's issue of Scientific American, just to give the attribution. This is talking about Ralph Steinman, who recently won the Nobel Prize. He is an interesting story of science. Dr. Steinman discovered dendritic cells while he was still a postdoctoral student in the 1970s, and he dedicated his life to understanding their pivotal role in adaptive immunity. Dendritic cells we've talked about multiple times on the program because they are so important to how our adaptive immunity works. Dendritic cells are a type of immune cell that takes in foreign antigens, bacteria or other compounds, viruses, and chops them up and finds the barcodes and displays them, antigenic signals, displays them on its surface, and then migrates actually over to where the young, uncommitted T cells are and secretes other compounds which cause the T cells to learn to attack that particular antigen. This also sets into regulation a different set of T cells, the T regulatory cells, which serve to act as a brake on the attack T cells. When this process works completely well, it allows us to resist diseases and have lifelong immunity. When it doesn't work well, we can end up with autoimmune disease and a host of other problems. Much of what we know about the immune system and many promising new therapies rely on this concept of dendritic cells. I'm sure someone will turn this into a novel because it is such a great story. Essentially, in 2007, Steinman discovered that he had pancreatic cancer. He had been working with people who were trying to develop cancer vaccines. He had his pancreas removed and bits of it saved and distributed to another researcher, Nicolette, who was working on vaccines, and they actually managed to get permission from the FDA to include Dr. Steinman in a single protocol experiment. So over the next couple of years, various anti-cancer vaccines were produced using different techniques from different laboratories all over the world, all of them directed at Dr. Steinman's cancer. He went through regular chemotherapy and then a number of dendritic cell vaccines, for example, one for melanoma, one that had been developed for kidney cancer, some other peptide vaccines, and an immune stimulant, which was still in the experimental stages. Ultimately, the story like this cannot end entirely happily, but it ended as well as it could. Instead of living a year, as most people with pancreatic cancer at the level that Dr. Steinman's was, he lived for 4 years. He lived long enough to actually be under consideration for a Nobel Prize. He received the preliminary award that often people get prior to accepting or receiving the Nobel Prize. And then 3 days after his death, the call came from the Nobel Commission that he had actually had won the prize. So because he had just died, it presented an enormous problem for the Nobel Committee. Traditionally, the awards cannot be given posthumously, although they have in recent years changed it to say that if the thing is announced, then you die after the announcement, you will receive the reward. Well, he died a few days before the announcement, but nevertheless, the committee met and decided to award the 2011 Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine to Dr. Steinman. And I wanted to take a moment and share his story with you because he was a true example of a scientist, and to the end, he was seeking to stamp out disease, even while experimenting effectively on himself. I also think that the collaboration of the medical community and the fact that in the very end, he was still gathering data and taking notes and trying to provide and preserve information that could be used to help others. I hope I go out that way. And thank you, Dr. Steinman. Now for something completely different. I like the story because it's one of those unintended consequences. Now, I don't think there's a person in the country who hasn't heard of Viagra. Viagra was a blockbuster drug. Sildenafil is its chemical name. And sildenafil works by blocking a particular enzyme called phosphodiesterase 5A. Now, this enzyme is responsible for the release of nitric oxide in the blood vessels through a series of steps. And when nitric oxide is released in blood vessel walls, the walls relax and open up and the blood vessels dilate and more blood rushes to whatever the target organ is. So in the case of Viagra, it proved very effective in helping men with erectile dysfunction, problems getting erections related to disease in their blood vessels. And actually, guys, for those of you in your 40s and 50s who are starting to have this issue, this is an early warning signal for heart disease. So if you're getting this and you haven't been to a doctor for, 5 or 10 years, which is, the typical guy thing, you really need to view this as a wake-up call. Well, it turns out, as usual, that drugs have other unintended uses. And in this case, recent research is suggesting that this might be the first effective therapy for a type of heart failure called diastolic dysfunction. In diastolic dysfunction, you don't relax the heart muscle. It simply cannot relax quickly enough for the heart to fill with blood. So instead of having the heart expand and contract and expand and contract and pump that blood, the ventricle is stiff and doesn't expand much. So the heart has to beat much more often to move the same amount of blood. And when a person needs increased blood, like, for example, to climb a hill or run a marathon, or even in the cases of people with this kind of heart failure, walk across the room, they may not be able to do that comfortably and they become short of breath. Well, it turns out that sildenafil inhibits something going on in the muscle cell as well. And the molecule in question is a muscle protein called titin. The titin is like a rubber band, and when it is phosphorylated, it relaxes. So using the Viagra actually may turn out to be a therapy for this type of heart failure. And this would be very, very interesting. There is a current study going on looking at whether or not this improves quality of life in patients with diastolic dysfunction. And in a related story, I recently discovered, this is the first really useful thing I've learned from a drug rep in a long, long time. But Cialis, another phosphodiesterase 5 inhibitor, also used for erectile dysfunction, has just gotten FDA approval for use for prostatic irritation. So for people who are having to get up 3 or 4 times in the middle of the night to pee, who feel like they're not emptying their bladder, this is a common problem that men get in their 50s, 60s, and 70s. 5 milligrams of Cialis a day has been shown to be an extremely effective treatment for this problem. Now, of course, it's an expensive drug and you have to fail less expensive drugs before your insurance will cover it. But nevertheless, it is important progress. And I'm kind of thinking that this group of drugs is proving to have a lot of other uses, which may make it appropriate for use in both males and females. So we're going to have some interesting research coming out with, a slight archness that goes with the whole erectile dysfunction thing that makes it kind of fun to talk about. We're going to go to our first email, this one from Margaret in Santa Cruz. Thank you, Dr. Dawn, for your interesting and educational program. Would you please comment on the substance known as Miracle Mineral Solution? A relative is taking this substance at the recommendation of her naturopath. My internet research shows that it is a solution of 28% sodium chlorite that one combines with an acid, such as citrus juice, that results in chlorine dioxide being formed in the intestine. There are multiple websites dedicated to its sales and testimonials from users. I'm concerned about the potential health risks of taking this substance. Well, Margaret, first of all, I want to comment that whenever you see a drug with the word miracle in its title, anything that's calling itself a miracle, your alert alarm, your neep, 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 BS alert alarm should start going off, because that's an awfully big claim. So unless it's holy water from Lourdes, anything with miracle in it, you gotta think twice. In terms of this actual substance, the book was written by an author, Jim Humble. It's called The Miracle Mineral Solution of the 21st Century. It's a self-published book, and it's promoted as a cure for AIDS, malaria, hepatitis, colds, acne, and many, many more things. There are no scientific reports of clinical efficacy, and I am really spooked by this stuff. This is a bleach. It's a type of industrial agent used for stripping textiles and in gray water treatment. It is not the sort of thing that people should be ingesting. I worry about chlorine in any form being ingested in large amounts, particularly because of its effect on the bowel flora. At the concentration that's produced with this product, 28%, it's very strong. It's sort of like drinking 20% bleach water. It's an extremely crazy thing to do. It's potentially very, very damaging to the body. And I want you to really try to get your friend to stop taking this stuff. There have been some studies in humans. There's one Department of Labor statistic of a fellow who was exposed to this as an aerosol, 19 parts per million as an aerosol, and it killed him. And in animal studies, inhalation at less than one part per million have resulted in deaths in rats. It's also been shown in monkeys to impair thyroid function and reduce the T4 cell count. The thyroid function makes sense because chloride will occupy your iodine receptors and your iodine won't be able to function well. So that makes sense that it would affect the thyroid. You know, it's so interesting to me, because the very people who would worry about eating soy because it might damage their thyroid, or who would worry about the side effect of relatively safe pharmaceuticals, will jump onto this miracle solution website with anecdotes and not be worried about this. And it's a bit of a disconnect for me. I don't understand the mentality, but I do see it. So I think this is a terribly dangerous thing for your friend to be doing, and I would urge you to try to get them to stop. Next email I have is from Polina in London. Polina sent a couple of emails, which I'm going to extract. She's 14 years old, and I'm very happy that you're contacting me. One of Polina's issues was that her period stopped this year because she went from 55 kilograms to 46 kilograms. That's basically going from about 118 pounds to 93 pounds, for those of us who still think in pounds, and obviously a very significant weight loss. At that time, her period stopped. When she gained some weight, they came back, but now they're gone again. And I want to tell you, Polina, that girls need a certain amount of body fat, probably about 20% at your age, in order for their bodies to give them a regular period. Many athletes and ballerinas and gymnasts, because they are so muscular and exercise so much, don't have enough body fat. We know that that is okay as long as you allow it to recover in your 20s, but it seems to me that you might want to get a little bit more comfortable with having a little bit more body fat and let your body tell you that you are in the right place. The fact that you had regular periods when you were heavier makes me feel comfortable that this is probably due to your weight loss and things have not just gotten back. The other thing that you asked me about was a weird sort of feeling in which you feel out of control and have a very kind of rush of ideas. This worries me, and I want to encourage you to go to your GP and ask for a referral for evaluation by a neuropsychiatrist. I think that you need to have a test for a type of epilepsy called temporal lobe epilepsy, which could certainly be experienced the way you describe your symptoms. It's very important that you get checked out, and if you describe these symptoms to your doctor, I don't think you'll have any trouble getting the referral. You should be grateful that you live in a country where healthcare, including specialty care, is covered. You will be able to access help In this country, unfortunately, someone in your situation might not be able to access good health care, and that would be a great shame. And we're going now to Maria Elena in Salinas. Hello, Maria Elena. Welcome to the program.
Hi there. Good morning.
Good morning.
After having a bone scan, I've been diagnosed with osteopenia, as it's called, and along with supplementary calcium with D and weight-bearing exercise, I have been prescribed Fosamax. I wonder what you think about it.
Are you postmenopausal?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And did any women in your family break a hip?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't really know. I can't say I do know.
All right. If there's no family history of hip fracture, then a lot depends on how high your T-scores are and what your FRAX, F-R-A-X, score is. As usual, in the United States, we've gone overboard with, it's like marketing 101. Create a need and then you fill it. So what's happened is that there's a drug for osteoporosis. So suddenly, that's not a big enough market. So why don't we expand the market by routinely testing all women over the age of 50 with a bone scan, creating this pseudo disease called osteopenia, and then we can treat all of those new people with this new pseudo disease. We've created a need and now we're filling it, and we're filling it with these bisphosphonates. Now, they do have their place in medical therapy. They are not bad drugs in the sense that, you know, this is a horrible thing to be doing, but it's got its downside, and you don't want to take something with a downside when you don't need it. And that, I think, is the situation for many women with osteopenia. What a FRAX score does, F-R-A-X, and there's a website in England. If you just put those letters into your browser, you will find that website. And you punch in your data, and it has to do with your alcohol consumption, whether you smoke, your age, your family history, and your T-scores. At that point, the computer gives you a statistical risk of fracture in the next 10 years. And if that statistical risk of fracture is at least 10%, then it makes a great deal of sense to be using a bisphosphonate. If that statistical risk is 2%, even if you have osteopenia by bone scan criteria, you probably don't need to be taking these drugs. We've now begun to see weird bone fractures, quite rare, but nevertheless, a new kind of bone fracture that didn't previously exist that only occurs in people who are on these drugs long term. So again, another part of the downside. People who get jaw infections, who have like really bad teeth, you can get, your body can't fight the jaw infection if you're taking a bisphosphonate because it can't grind up the infected bone properly. So the infection can get out of hand. Also very rare, but kind of nasty and creepy. And again, why take a small risk of a nasty thing when you're not getting a significant benefit? I can't think of a reason.
Gosh, that's great. That's wonderful information. So is the T-score, I mean, is that under the umbrella of the FRAX?
Yes, you'll be plugging that in. It's just you fill out a little online form. And actually, I can give you the website. My producer, Charlie, has gotten it up. It's www.shef.ac.uk/FRAX, F-R-A-X. And I'll be putting that on the website, so if you didn't get it, you can go to the Ask Dr. Dawn website and find a link to it by the end of next week.
All right.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Let's go now to JC in SC.
Hello.
Hello, you're on the air.
Thank you. I was listening to your talk on the immune response and things of that nature, and I wanted to interject the possibility of the way we treat the food, specifically animals, and a possible relationship to dysfunction of our system related to their stress hormones. And the thing that brings it up is I saw a YouTube video yesterday on the turkey farms, the butterball turkeys, and these people who were rounding up the turkeys and dealing with them, they were kicking them across the room. They would drag them by the neck. They'd hit them with sticks. Their eyes were poked out. It was just, it is so sad, the treatment of these animals. And I've also seen videos where this cow was on the back of a truck and they wanted to get it off, so they backed the truck off and they put on the brakes. The cow slid off the back, broke its back legs. Dogs were after it for about 8 hours, and they process this for food. And we're consuming how well the food we eat.
Well, I think it's sort of a metaphysical issue and an energetic issue rather than a direct chemical issue. You know, from a scientific standpoint, first of all, dying generally creates a surge of adrenaline. It's very hard to kill an animal, even with a quote-unquote humane method that doesn't create a lot of adrenaline. And I'm not condoning cruelty to animals. I want you to understand that I'm able to afford free-range everything. And if it's not free-range and organic and lived a happy, healthy life until someone bonked it on the head with a whatever is the current quote-unquote humane method of killing an animal, I won't eat it. But not everyone can afford that, and animal protein is a very important part of the diet. Yes, someday we need to get onto an all-vegetable or vegetarian diet because the carrying capacity of the planet for 14 billion people simply won't support meat animals. It's a non-starter if we get to that level of population. So ultimately, I think we'll evolve beyond this just out of sheer numbers and necessity. That being said, I think that you're more in danger from the compounds, not the adrenaline and stress hormones that will, you know, pretty much be broken down by your digestive tract very early. These are complex, very elaborate molecules. I could drink adrenaline and it's not going to get into my bloodstream. I mean, I could drink pure adrenaline. It's going to be broken down in my gut. But some of the compounds that do get through, like the hormones, the antibiotics, these are serious issues, plus what this kind of farming does to the environment and, in fact, to the souls of the farmers is a type of pollution that I think needs to be addressed. So
yeah, I guess I might not have gotten it out there, but I guess if you have this animal under stress for, let's say, a year, their whole physiology is going to change relative to being in the free-range situation and at
right.
the...
Yeah, they'll have more. They'll have more fat. They'll have more, and they'll have a lot more omega-6. They won't have, the meat will be different. The meat will have more saturated fat in it. That's all true. And of course, we know that saturated fat's one of the problems with a meat-based diet. So you make a good point. And I think that there are a lot of reasons to want to eat less meat and to only eat meat that is farmed in a humane fashion. And any kind of industrial food production will generally deteriorate to the profit motive and away from humanity.
I guess that's just the point that I want to get across, but your screener there, he said, have you ever heard of Michael Pollan? And yes, I have, and I know you have too, but I would urge everybody to watch Food, Inc. by Michael Pollan.
If anybody knows Michael Pollan personally, because he's just up at Berkeley, I have tried to get him to come on this show, and I think we have a reasonable footprint in the web space, but we're kind of small time locally, and you know, Berkeley looks down at Santa Cruz. Does anybody know him out there within the sound of my voice who could maybe give him a call and tell him how great it would be if he came on the show? I would certainly love to have the opportunity to have this discussion with him. He's a fabulous journalist, and I think he's made a significant contribution to society. So I'd love to give him a chance to celebrate that on the air.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay. Well.
Thanks for the call. Bye-bye. We're going to take one email before we go to our next caller. This from Jane in Florida. Please help me, Dr. Don. I'm 56 and 2 years ago contracted genital herpes from my husband and developed a post-herpetic neuralgia. What a nightmare of pain. No subsequent outbreaks, but the pain was horrendous. It's controlled reasonably well by gabapentin, but I cannot have intercourse or it feels though I will be stretched and torn even though my gynecologist says it looks fine. It's hard to describe the pain. Never had any issues before. I tried Premarin cream and all sorts of moisturizers, but nothing helps. I've researched it, but can find no real help. Please, I'm willing to travel to resolve this. It's destroying my marriage, even though my husband feels bad. Well, Jane, I'm happy to tell you that I think that there is a solution for you. I want to suggest that you go right out and buy this book, which is written by Deborah Cody. I'm going to spell it C-O-A-D-Y-M-D. It's called Healing Painful Sex. Having read this book, and by the way, I recommend this to all doctors and nurses because we do not get taught the important information about pelvic pain in medical school or in nursing school, and we do the automatic default a lot of the time and assume it's a psychological disorder. This is a real entity, and in the case of Jane, what has probably happened is that she has either sustained persistent nerve damage or she's developed a reflex arc in which light touch stimulates spasm of her deep pelvic muscles. That spasm and shortening of the muscles got started during her herpes outbreak and has now become an automatic kind of knee-jerk reflex when the area is stimulated. This is an incredibly disabling condition, and it can be progressive and start causing problems with bladder control and with pain from even just sitting on a hard surface. So it needs to be addressed promptly. I actually don't know where Dr. Cody practices or if she still practices, but this book will give you the information you need to start finding a cure. So I wanted to put that out there. Healing Painful Sex by Deborah Cody, C-O-A-D-Y, and that's the Seal Press. So please go get that book, Jane. There is help for you. Let's go now to our next caller, and that's Catherine in Soquel. Hello, Catherine. Welcome to the program.
Hi there. Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I was diagnosed earlier this year with rheumatoid arthritis and have been going through the motions trying to eliminate some of the things that we think might have caused it. And I'm on the sort of triple threat methotrexate, Plaquenil, and now Humira, and still not getting complete relief. And recently came home from a trip from South Dakota where my symptoms were pretty reduced, and came home, and within an hour of being in my bedroom, I started to have an experience, a pretty awful flare-up. And after thinking about it a little bit, I think, of course, the humidity in Santa Cruz might affect my condition to an extent, but our bedroom has had some water damage.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if you know much about the connection between molds and autoimmune disease or rheumatoid arthritis.
Right. Yeah, there's a huge connection. Okay, so I'm going to recommend another author named Richie Shoemaker, who has written a number of books. One of them's called something like Toxic Homes, and the other one's called Mold Warriors. But the most recent book has got all the information in it. It's big, it's thick, it's very repetitious. It's got a lot of anecdotal stuff. I've met Dr. Shoemaker. He's a big ego, and he needs an editor. So it's a bit hard going, but the information is really valuable. And the gist of it is that about 20 years ago, they introduced a additive into paints, and it was supposed to restrict mold. It was toxic to mold, so it was like an anti-molding paint, which was a great idea because mold is always an issue. And it poisoned most of the molds, but it acted as a potent mutagen, and it actually caused molds to become mutated, and some of these mutated molds are much, much more antigenic than they used to be. And unfortunately, this has gotten into the sort of building material food chain now, and it's very possible that you have a mold issue and that mold spores in your bedroom are activating your immune system. Earlier on this show, we were talking about the dendritic cells. And effectively what happens is that the dendritic cells take these mold toxins and you develop several processes that happen, but you develop antibodies against the mold toxins. And the toxins themselves actually have biological activity that upregulate the immune system. So you may be in a toxic building situation, and that flare-up is very suggestive. There are other explanations. It could be that you ate something. There's definitely dietary components with rheumatoid arthritis in some people where they have gut permeability issues, so antigens from food get into their bloodstream and, again, trigger the immune response. And yes, humidity, barometric pressure, these are all factors, although in general I would expect South Dakota to be pretty cold and damp this time of year.
The humidity there was 30% on average.
And what is it here?
70.
Okay, so in general, humidity, if you keep the place warm, isn't such a big deal, but it's a big jump, and it could explain it. But I think you would be, if it was just the humidity, I think you would have that problem a lot going from outside to inside environments,
right.
For example.
How does one go about determining if this is a factor? Do you test the house? Do you test your body?
Well, this is a big, big topic. Probably for mold, the simplest thing to do is to get a complement C4A subfraction, C4A subfraction of complement, and a melanocyte stimulating protein tests. And these are both blood tests. They are not done by Quest, but they are done by LabCorp. It'll run you a couple $100. I don't know if your insurance will cover it. If you score at the upper quartile on both of those tests, but particularly the C4A, it indicates mold-related illness. These are experimental testing. We are in alternative land when we talk about this. I happen to think it's legitimate alternative land. I've, you know, looked at Shoemaker's data and it's persuasive, but it's still going to be hotly debated. There are people who will do environmental remediation, and there are people who will test your home for mold spores. But since you already have rheumatoid disease and you're thinking that you've become a canary, so to speak, then testing yourself, and these are the physiologic markers which would indicate a problem.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much.
The book, by the way, is Surviving Mold by Richie Shoemaker.
Surviving Mold.
Yeah. And I got my copy from Amazon, so it's okay. Readily available.
Great. Thank you so much.
Good luck. Oh, okay. And one more thing. Get your vitamin D level up to about 65 or 70. That's very helpful with autoimmune disease. And you'll have to do a blood test and see what it is and then supplement. You won't get there unless you are a lifeguard who never wears sunscreen, you won't get it up to 70 with the sun, not around here.
I take quite a bit of cod liver oil.
Check a blood level.
Okay.
All right. Good
luck. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Let's take one moment to read another email. This from Avery in Curtistown, Hawaii. I need your help because I've been battling staph and infection, and antibiotics seem to keep triggering fungal infections. I started off with a fungal infection on my foot. None of the over-counter stuff worked. I started an oral antifungal, but not long after, I developed bumps on my back and stomach that looked like mosquito bites or acne. They tested positive for staph, and here on the east side of the Hawaiian island, we've been getting some of the worst rain ever. I guess Hawaii's getting all of our rain because we haven't had any. We're talking 12 inches a day, which the doctor said could certainly create the staph and fungal infections. My problem is I can't seem to get rid of either problem. Basically, I won't read the rest of the email, but when Avery tries to treat one, the other gets worse and vice versa. So Avery, a couple of bits of strict advice here. Get some Bactroban or Mucoprosin ointment and start putting it in your nose every day. That will reduce the amount of staph that is on your body. You also want to keep your fingernails short and take a body lotion, a clean body lotion that's in a squirt bottle, and put about 10% by volume of tea tree oil in there. Tea tree oil plus a nice basic body lotion will put a layer of antifungal and antibacterial material on your skin. And at that strength does not usually result in any kind of dermatitis. For the actual fungal infection that you've got, I'm going to tell you about the Sporinox and Sweat treatment. You take about 2,000 milligrams of Sporinox, which is an antifungal, once, and then you work up a sweat, and you sweat like crazy for about 2 hours, or you can go into a sauna, whatever it takes, drink lots of water. That sweat comes out everywhere in your body and basically wipes out the fungus that's currently on you, and then you have to do your environmental decontamination. So that means 10% bleach foot bath when you step out of the shower and let it dry on your skin. You want a 10% bleach spray, and you're going to hit all of the surfaces that are wood and hard surfaces in your bathroom, in your bedroom. You want to keep the spore count down. You're going to get lots of sheets, because you're going to change your sheet every day until you get a hand on this, because you need to keep your environment really clean while you eradicate this from your body. Also, high-dose probiotics, because with all the antibiotics you've been taking, you're really going to mess up your stool flora, and that's not a happy-making thing for the ongoing future. So let's go now to the phones, and we've got Bruce. Go ahead.
Yes, I am a fair person. I've got light skin. I've got very light brown hair. I've got green eyes. I sunburn easily. In about 6 months, I've had my arm twisted, and I'm forced to be going to Hawaii for 2 months with my brother on a sailboat. It's lots of sun.
Oh, boy.
And
As far as
I know, there's only two ways to deal with it. One is have darker skin. The other is to carry a bucket of sunscreen.
Well, no. No, that's not true. What we're going to do is we're going to put you in a graduated tanning bed situation. You're going to get the long-sleeved, very lightweight clothing that's SPF 50, and you're going to wear that when you're out there on the water.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're going to at least have to wear a long-sleeve shirt to protect your upper back and neck. There are garments, essentially, that are helpful for this. Most of them come from Australia and New Zealand, where they have that big hole in the ozone layer. And and it's warm down there, and they've come up with lightweight, very good sunscreen clothing. And so you want to use a combination of things. Yes, you should use sunblock, and ideally something that's like an occlusive barrier, like zinc oxide, because nothing gets through zinc oxides. It's a very effective one. You're going to look funky, but, you know, you're on a sailboat. So whatever, you're going to look funky. You can deal with that. I would also condition my skin. And even very fair-skinned people can be sailors if they work at it. And so get a tanning booth membership somewhere. And in the months leading up to this trip, if you really must take this trip and are really kind of trapped, which is what I'm hearing you say, then you're going to gradually build up a layer of melanin. It'll happen. You'll get some melanin. Even the Fitzgerald 1 people, if they do a little bit, like 5 minutes and then, you know, 5 minutes a day for a week and then take it up to 6 minutes and so on, you can build up enough melanin layer to be relatively protective. And it's all relative, but you can make it better for yourself.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, I can do that.
Yeah.
And
do that. Buy the clothing. And experiment with various different forms of zinc oxide or titanium oxide sunscreens just for pliability and wearability and sweatability and all those other things.
Mm-hmm. One more thing that I ran into, idea based on some research done at the University of Arizona in the early 90s, and that was the idea of directly stimulating melanin production. And there is a company in Australia that is producing an implant because it's a peptide, and as such, it won't go through the digestive system.
Interesting.
So it has to be given an SQ injection.
Cool.
I talked to my doctor. He hadn't heard about it
all. I haven't either. It's probably not FDA approved, would be my guess.
That's why.
Yeah, you might be able to get it under the table or... I mean, I don't know what your financial situation is, but flying to Australia to get the implant seems a little much. It may be available in Mexico. You could look into that. Contact the manufacturer in Australia and find out where they sell it. If you could go down to Mexico and get it, you know, that might be something to think about. Just brainstorming a little bit for you.
Okay,
and
well,
also,
it's being used to treat impetigo.
Impetigo, yeah. Cosmetics Database by the Environmental Working Group has a very good database for sunscreens to help you pick one that it does not have a lot of dangerous chemicals in it. So you've got a link on my website to Cosmetics Database. So just go to resources on the Ask Dr. Don website. All right, I'm going to sign off.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And now, Marion, thank you for waiting.
Hi there.
Hi.
I really appreciate your show. And I turned on the radio in the middle of you were saying something about animal protein being an important part of the human diet.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a common misconception. I don't believe that that's a proven fact, so I wanted to voice my contrary opinion.
Mm-hmm.
I've been immersing myself in nutrition information for about 5 years since I decided to go vegan for ethical reasons. And there's a couple of vegan dietitians who make a strong effort to be unbiased and review the science on the issues involving diet and comparing, you know, vegan diets versus meat-based diets. And, of course, it's really hard to do research on nutrition because it's hard to get people to eat what you tell them to eat. It's hard to get them to remember what they eat and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's the problem of wild-type humans versus lab rats.
Yeah. So, there's a couple of websites that I think are useful. One is Jack Norris with two R's. RD, and that stands for registereddietitian.com. And there's also another dietitian, and her website is theveganrd.com. And I think if you read them and see that they're really looking at as much research as they can, you can see that it's another way of looking at it.
I want to just say that I have been practicing medicine in Santa Cruz County for 20 years now, and so I've definitely had a lot of vegans in my medical practice.
Yeah.
And the general average person can do very well on a vegan diet as long as they are not compromised. The basic issue with vegan protein is if you're getting all of your protein that way, it's harder physiologically to assemble the compounds. It's more work. That doesn't mean it's impossible. And the compounds require more digestive input. You need to have better, stronger digestive enzymes.
Mm.
Meat proteins, animal proteins are sort of preformed, if you will, and the combination, the ratios of amino acids that are coming in are the ideal ratios for making more meat, which is what we're made of.
Mm.
And so when you have a compromised digestive tract, an older patient, a very young patient, and particularly a sickly infant, obviously infants cannot be vegan, right? They need milk. That is, in fact, an absolute requirement.
They need mother's milk.
They need mother's milk. That's still an animal product. And I'm just saying that there are some some points.
If they can't get mother's milk, they can have formulas that have been specially formulated.
And which don't work nearly as well. Now I'm ethical treatment of animals. We're not having that discussion. Okay, we're trying to have the scientific discussion. You know, I think when you're well, a well adult can definitely get by on a vegan diet, and older children, if they're carefully monitored. And I do mean carefully monitored, and you're watching their growth curves and they're okay, I think that's an appropriate thing to do.
I know a fair number of people who...
Infants.
You know, babies have been vegan their whole life.
I'm making the argument they aren't vegan. I'm making the argument that
because they've had mother's milk. Okay.
Right. I'm making the argument that they're not eating only plant products.
Okay.
And, you know, that's...
Yeah, I don't know.
You know, the aliens that come down and meet us that aren't mammalian are going to be so creeped out by the idea that we drink this secretion from a modified sweat gland. Mm-hmm. That's just going to totally weird them out, because that is really creepy. But,
yeah.
You know, it's natural and it's normal for us. And so, and we're mammals. So, yeah, we're going to do that. And that, I think, is my point, that you have to be contextual. There's nuances here. And with a sick patient, I'm going to suggest that they are doing some eggs. You know, if they want to be ethical about it, you know, do organic eggs that are gathered by Pollyanna on the farm from Happy Chickens. And that would be just fine with me. And I don't think there's an ethical issue there. But
do you have a particular, was there a source of information that says that we need eggs or that we need animal proteins because it's...
No, I'm saying if I'm, as a doctor, when I'm trying to treat a sickly patient, if they're vegan and they're having trouble getting their nutrition, and I do see people who aren't getting what they need from a vegan diet, but they're always sick with something. So if they're a healthy vegan, it's great. You go.
But there are sick people who are vegan and sick people who are...
Right. And when you're sick and vegan, it can be extremely difficult to get what you need to get well so that you can be vegan again, so that you can be a healthy vegan. So there are times when our physiology is challenged, when I think it is practical to resort to animal protein. And if that's an ethical issue for my patient, then that's fine. We don't do that. But I am saying that it sure does help. Okay?
You know, I think it's quite possible that some people do better with some animal protein. But I don't know... that's necessarily the way to go with such people. I mean,
I understand what you're saying.
Experience of it helping, and that's great, but I think it's just a logical jump, unless there's research that shows that we really do need the animal proteins in order to combine the amino acids properly.
It's just a matter of degree. And, I will go and scan around and see what research I can find. I think I can probably find at least some case studies on people with nutritional deficiencies related to an appropriate vegan diet. So that's where I'll go look. And I'll put it out if I find it, okay?
And just to say one other thing is that I think we take for granted things like heart disease or cancer of the colon or, you know, various things that are brought on more by an animal-based diet. And that when you see somebody who's vegan and they're not getting enough B12, you think, oh, well, that can't be good for you or natural. But in truth, you know, we have plenty of disease caused by too much animal products. And we just take that for granted. I think that's blind in that way.
I will agree with your first premise as far as the take it for granted thing. Not, I don't, but thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay. Yeah, and thanks for pointing out the environmental aspect, too.
You're welcome. Have a great day.
Okay.
Bye-bye. So let's take a moment and share with you one really nice email I got from Rachel Ruby, who's in Santa Cruz, and she is a nurse practitioner at Dominican Hospital, and she wanted to be sure that everybody knew about the new Dominican Hospital Mobile Clinic, which provides care for the uninsured and underinsured patients in Santa Cruz County. They operate Monday through Thursday from 9 to 3, and they go around the county, Aptos, Santa Cruz, Scotts Valley, and Felton. And you can go to the Dominican website. Just check that out. I think it's DominicanCHW.edu, but I'm not certain about that website, but you'll find it if you search. And look at that schedule. If you need health care, if you're uninsured, if you've got a problem, there's a clinic for you that is made possible by Dominican Hospital. So definitely a community resource to make sure it gets out there. And thank you, Rachel, for the ping reminding me to do that. Let's go to a final email from Elizabeth in the Philippines. I'm glad to have a chance to do this one. Elizabeth is having problems with her knees and her elbows, and I won't go into a lot of details, but poor Elizabeth has had patellofemoral syndrome, which is a loose kneecap, and she's had cartilage repairs, and she's had steroids, and she's gotten really messed up. I want to encourage you, Elizabeth, to look up Muncie, M-U-N-C-I-E, exercises. You can look that up on the internet. It's named after the university at Muncie, Indiana, who invented this. It's a very good exercise for stabilizing the kneecap. It's extremely effective, even in people who have had to have surgery. If you can get the balance of the muscles, you can really help things. With respect to the elbow problems you're having, I would suggest padding your elbows at night. A lot of times, if a person is getting elbow pain after spending a long, hard day at the computer, just padding that elbow at night and allowing it to be extended. I just take a sweater and cut a sleeve off and then roll that up into a little donut and wear the donut over the elbow. It keeps you from bending it at night, and it keeps you from lying on it, and that can clear up a lot of elbow pain in a few weeks, so certainly worth a try. And I hope it's been worth the hour listening to Ask Dr. Don. I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have, and I hope you'll be back next week when we'll be taking more of your calls and emails. Until then, so long and stay healthy.